Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. I want to remind everyone that this is the beginning of a new concept. We used to start with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, but that ended on Election Day. What started yesterday and will continue through the rest of God knows how long is a political limerick. And for those of you who read The Nation magazine, remember Calvin Trillin is to The Nation, as now our political limericist is to The Attitude.
Istanbul was Constantinople, now it's Istanbul, now Constantinople, been a long time gone. Constantinople, now it's Turkish delight on a moonlit night. Every gal in Constantinople lives in Istanbul, now Constantinople, so view the day in Constantinople, she'll be waiting in Istanbul.
Today's political limerick is as follows. The popular vote isn't even in doubt. Joe Biden is blowing Trump out. Ah, but in our great nation, land means more than population. Some votes have more value and clout.
Even old New York was once New Amsterdam. Why they changed it, I can't say. You just liked it better that way. Istanbul was Constantinople, now it's Istanbul, now Constantinople.
With that, we are speaking to someone who has some tremendous value and lots of clout, especially in Texas. Scott Braddock is the editor of The Quorum Report, the voice of Texas, the dean of the Austin Press Corps. I'm in therapy, Scott. What the frick happened in Texas? I was hearing everything. I was hearing the Democrats could flip the legislature. Mm-hmm. I heard Donald Trump lose. And then as the votes came in, I'm like, what Texas were they talking about? Because I'm not seeing that with the numbers. So welcome to the program and thank you.
Well, it's always good to be here with you, Arnie, even virtually on Zoom. But I must tell you, and I must say, how many times did I say on this program there are more Republican voters in Texas than there are Democratic ones? Did I say that more than once? If I said it once, I said it a million times. And I think that the Texas people were thinking of was the one where Republicans got caught with their pants down in 2018 and didn't take the challenge from Democrats seriously. And they didn't take the backlash to President Trump seriously and didn't take the backlash to Senator Ted Cruz seriously. And there were certainly some legislative races in 2018 where that was just true, and you had Republican candidates who were losing, who hadn't really spent any money or done anything to try to win their races. You know, in September and October of that year, they still didn't think any of this was for real. All seemed like a bunch of hype. And I was going back to 2014, looking at the covers of Texas Monthly magazine. The cover would be Wendy Davis and the Castro brothers. The cover says, "Game on," and that was "Game on?" question mark. One of the subsequent covers after Wendy Davis announced for governor in 14, there she is standing with her pink running shoes, and it says, "Game on." Now, you remember what happened after the game was on. In 2014, Democrats lost every statewide race by 21 points. It just didn't matter, all of the hype. And all of the money, too. It's not as if Democrats didn't have funding. In 2014, there was $40 million spent on behalf of Wendy Davis to try to put her in the governor's mansion. Didn't work out. Greg Abbott beat her by 21 points. And that's an election where there were about 4 million people who voted, something like that. So, you know, in 2018, the number was double. It was 8.4 million people who voted. You had Beto O'Rourke spend $80 million, only to come up just short of beating Ted Cruz. So we still have all these young folks, new participants in politics, newly ensconced combatants in politics in Texas who are maybe more progressive, more liberal, but their only frame of reference for a winning campaign in Texas is one that they still lost to Ted Cruz in 2020. Republicans were not going to let that happen again. And I was talking to Republican consultants as early as January about this, who had said that, Scott, we're going to take some seats back in the legislature that we lost last time in 2018. We're going to work on really not just being on defense here. Most media is portraying it that way, that the Republicans are on defense, that their backs are against the wall and all of that. And we just never talked about it that way here. The Attitude, Arnie, I mean, we talked over and over again about how these guys were going to, the Empire Strikes Back, you know, if you will. Democrats always announce what they're going to do to win these elections. And I've seen this over and over again. It was true when Battleground Texas came into the state years ago. That was going back to 2014. We're going to spend this money. We're going to build Democratic infrastructure, which, of course, at that point, I would always joke that Democratic infrastructure in Texas was like actual infrastructure in Afghanistan. There's plenty of Democrats in Texas, but nothing that really connects them. You know, just like in Afghanistan, if you lived in one village, you could live there your whole life, and there could be another village 3 miles away that you don't know anything about. There's no roads. There's no telecommunications.
No way to get there from here.
Well, there was a cheaper way to build some political infrastructure through social media. And you saw Beto O'Rourke do that. You know, when he was traveling the state and doing his traveling roadshow to all 254 counties, it's not that he flipped votes in those rural counties. It's the people watching on Facebook Live in places like Dallas and Houston and San Antonio and Austin. They were getting fired up by this guy. So earlier this year, when I was talking to these Republican consultants, I said, well, how many seats do you think you can really win back in the legislature, given this new reality and given the fact that so many more people are participating in the political process now? I mean, it's pretty much accepted, even among Republicans, that increased voter turnout is bad for them, right? I mean, that's why you see some of the what folks would call voter suppression efforts and all of that. They did a lot of things that are just basic fundamental politics. One, they went out and they registered new voters who they suspected.
You talked about this for months.
That's right. They registered at least 300,000 new Republican voters in Texas. Of course, we don't register people by party, but they can tell how folks are going to vote based on, you know, asking them some questions about being pro-life and pro-Second Amendment, all that sort of stuff, and geography and where they're at. The next thing they did was they spent a lot of money, which they did not feel the need to do in 2018. They didn't take it as seriously at that time. There were these Democratic groups. I'll give you an example. One called Forward Majority, which is a big super PAC that was going around the country and spending money in legislative races, trying to flip seats in state legislatures. Forward Majority had announced earlier in the year they were going to spend $6 million in Texas for that purpose. And then more recently, they said they were doubling that investment to $12 million. But that was in a press release, and so it gets, you know, it ends up blasted out there on the Texas Tribune and whatever else. And in the meantime, Republicans don't care about announcing that they're spending money; they just do it. There are certain deadlines by which these candidates and PACs have to report their expenditures and their contributions. In Texas, they must report 30 days out from the election, so you get to see kind of a picture 1 month before the election. And then there's one more report that comes a week before the election. There's an 8-day report. And on the 8-day report, we were able to see that a group called Texans for Lawsuit Reform, which is sort of inextricably linked to Karl Rove from decades ago when they were working on judicial races here in Texas.
Karl has been a wreck about what could possibly happen, so he has been a big mover and shaker.
It's my understanding that Rove has been very adamant, evangelical even, about the idea that in this election cycle, money in Texas needed to stay in Texas and not go to other places. So that group, Texans for Lawsuit Reform, in the last 3 weeks, on their report, it was shown that they spent $11 million. Now, that was on top of what Governor Abbott was doing, which was at least $1.8 million. And at some point, he spent more like $5 or $6 million. So you have these Republican office holders who are putting money into it, but also these large political action committees who were basically matching the Democrats, if not overspending them dollar for dollar down the stretch. It's not as if Democrats put forth this great effort and then just ran into a brick wall that was already there. It was that Republicans were fighting back and fighting back hard. So in some of these legislative races, and I hadn't seen anything like this, Arnie, if it was high school football previously a decade ago, now we're in the National Football League as far as how much money they're spending and how much technological advancements have been made in these campaigns. They also did, other than spending money, they also did just the fundamental thing, and we talked about this as well, in legislative races, local races, and congressional races as well, they were one-on-one talking to voters in person in their neighborhoods, which Democrats refused to do. Now, you have a pandemic going on, and I get the sensitivity, but as one of the NBC News journalists who's based in Texas wrote on social media yesterday, we knew months ago that block walking can be done safely during the pandemic. You know, that the science shows that it's okay to knock on somebody's door and step back 10 feet with a mask on and talk to somebody if they feel comfortable talking to them. But Democrats were just sort of locking themselves in their houses all over the state. I always just kind of kick back with a cigar, Arnie, and I wonder, how are Democrats, whenever they have the chance to win in this state, how are they going to mess it up? In this instance, it was that I think they overcorrected for what they thought people's sensitivities were about the pandemic. I talked about this previously. It's worth repeating. In mid-September, we wrote about this at quorumreport.com. We were first to do so. I went along with some block walkers, Republican block walkers up in Tarrant County, where Fort Worth is, and witnessed what they were doing. And as they say in East Texas, it ain't rocket surgery. What they were doing, they would walk up to the door, put some literature on the door, knock on the door, and then step back 10 feet with their mask on. If the person came out to talk to them, they talked to them. If the person didn't seem comfortable, they didn't talk to them and they just moved on. Remember, Democrats, the only physical thing that was occurring there was putting the literature on the door, which Democrats were doing. They were doing what they called a lit drop, you know, just putting literature on the doors, but they wouldn't even knock on the door, wouldn't even, you know, ring the doorbell to then talk to people. Now, you can reach out to folks in other ways, of course. You can talk to people on social media. You can talk to people by phone banking and these sorts of things. But it is not the same as you've been a candidate, Arnie, for the legislature. You know, it is not the same as going to an event, having coffee with people, or just standing on their doorstep and talking to them about the issues that matter. Because guess what? Often, it's not what you say to them. It's what are they saying to you, right? Because you're gathering two things at once. You're getting to figure out you're accomplishing two things at once. You're putting yourself in front of them. But you're also learning what things you need to be talking about to other people when you go talk to them. It's what did the voters say?
Right. All right, a couple of things. So what happened in the Texas legislature? How many seats did they gain? And what is the numbers now? And what's happening with the speaker's race? I'm doing all these things because I know that the speaker was damaged goods.
Yep.
I know there was going to be a new speaker. I know the Democrats were actually thinking they could actually take over the House. So someone was actually announcing they may be running for speaker. But now that the landscape has sort of settled, Republicans are very, very comfortable in control. They did the heavy lifting. And let's just say one other thing. You have institutional memory for turning out votes and for organizing on a Republican scale in Texas. The Democrats have not for a long time. They either had either given up or they were relatively new to this. They had a flush of money. But one of the things I saw was one of the Democrats running for the Texas House used a picture of the state capitol, but it was in Austin. I mean, it was like, this is they hired out-of-state consultants because they haven't really sort of created their homegrown consultants to help them. It's great. The out-of-state consultant earned a lot of money, but they didn't understand the Texas landscape. They didn't know exactly how to sort of push the right buttons. And what the Republicans were able to do was use the muscle they had and just make it sort of pump it up even more. As you point out, 2018 was a wake-up call. So they were a well-oiled machine by 2020 and ready to do battle. And I think the Democrats just assumed that it would be the same sort of repeat of 2018. God help us, no way.
In some ways, it was fortunate for Republicans that the Speaker of the House flamed out in that controversial recording last year with the third party group where he was trying to sell out members of his own party and all that, because usually it's the Speaker who would be the one sort of looking at things in a global sense and trying to figure out which candidates need more help and who needs to have money directed to them, who needs more field operations and all that sort of stuff. In this case, there is no Texas House leadership right now. There's no hierarchy in the Texas House. And so the big professionals moved in. Karl Rove and Dave Carney, who you know. Carney, who told one of the newspapers here that it was a, quote, retarded strategy to not be knocking on doors and getting out and doing field operations and locking themselves in their houses on the Democratic side. You had voter registration efforts, as we mentioned, and all of these other fundamental things that the Republicans were doing to try to hold on to power, and they did. To answer your question, Arnie, after more than $20 million, as far as I can tell, was spent on legislative races, it might be approaching $25 million whenever all is said and done. And I'm thinking about the outside PACs. The candidates had so much money. In some of these races, they were $2.5 or $3 million races. When you looked at a Texas House seat, easily a Texas House seat in Collin County cost about $1.5 to $1.7 million to win this time around, where the other candidate would have around $1 million or something like that. After all that money was spent, there was basically a wash. One Republican lost in Houston and one Democrat lost in the Houston area.
Oh my God.
And that's it. After all of that, you know, after all of the hype, after all of the big push and everything. And look, at the statewide level, things have shifted up a little bit. Senator John Cornyn was able to win by 9 or 10 points, but you did have the president who in 2016 won Texas by 9 points. Instead, it was within a 7-point race in Texas. So at a statewide level, things are moving in the Democrats' direction, but a loss is still a loss.
Explain to me the Hispanic vote. That is mind-boggling. I understood what happened in Florida. I understood completely. I understand the Cuban mentality. I know a lot of Cubans. I understand them. They're my age, so I know those, not the parents, not the children. But Texas, I don't get it. So hold my hand and explain what happened. Or did they just not have a good get out the vote or communication, or did they not understand?
No.
What were the sort of inputs into this community as they exercised the franchise?
Three things. One, Hispanics and Latinos, those are not interchangeable.
No, I know.
You didn't do that, but I want people to understand it.
I know.
Two, it's real easy to understand it. Hispanic means that there is some Spanish background. Latino just means they're Latin. So, for example, Brazilians are Latin, but not Hispanic. So there is overlap. But anyway, that's the first thing. Second thing is that they're not monolithic. In Texas, you're basically mostly talking about Mexican Americans. In Florida, you're talking probably about Cuban Americans.
Right.
And then some other places you'd be talking about
Puerto Ricans as well.
Other nationalities and other places. In New York, I guess a lot of Puerto Ricans as well, right? Thirdly, because we're talking about Mexican Americans in Texas, they're generally more conservative than, say, somebody who is Latino or Hispanic who is in California. Studies have shown, I would point people to a few different things that I'm going to send you, Arnie. Studies have shown, and this is why it's so crazy to me, that when you hear from these nativists who just hate Mexicans, hate Hispanics, it's so bizarre, but they say that these people want to come in and change our country. Hispanic people are the quickest to assimilate to wherever they move to. When you have Hispanics move into Texas, what they see around them is pretty conservative politics and entrepreneurialism and all of that.
They want to be successful.
They want to be like the folks who are around them.
Right.
And so you have folks who tend to be more conservative and are sympathetic to Republican messages. In California, they're more liberal because that's what's all around them, right? These are exactly the people that you should not fear are coming in to try to change the place where you're at. It is the case. That's at least three things. Here's a fourth thing. Democrats in Texas, and I heard this immediately. You should have seen the text messages on this phone on election night from Latino Democrats from the Valley who said to me, texting to me, once again, Texas Democrats take Hispanics for granted and don't do anything to try to win them over and just assume that if they vote, they're going to vote for Democrats instead of going and talking to them. Look, the Republican Party in Texas has a long-standing history of having an ongoing conversation with Hispanics. President and former governor George W. Bush really started this. It continued with Rick Perry.
Rick Perry.
And in a big way, it's continued with Governor Abbott, who in his first bid for election in 2014, put a lot of money into South Texas, into the Valley, which was seen at, you know, you do these things, not just in the current election cycle, you do things over time, you make investments in places to try to talk to and communicate with these different people about different issues. And at the time, I remember Republicans saying they were very excited about the idea that they had a new region of the state that they could sort of go into and really start working and start talking to people about why they ought to be conservative, why they ought to be Republican. You know, it was former President Bush who did say that family values don't end at the Rio Grande. It was sort of a recognition that these folks can not only be Americans, but also be Republicans. You know, I mean, before 2006, when Bush tried to push for immigration reform and that all fell apart in 2006, 2007, when he had a Democratic Congress to work with, he thought maybe he could get that done in bipartisan fashion, but it didn't happen. And that was sort of the original birth of what would become the Tea Party by 2010, when they had these nativists who were pushing back. And remember, they were saying on the Republican side, they were saying that President Bush was somebody who wanted to sell us out to Mexico and, you know, was embracing the quote unquote illegal immigrants and all of that. But Texas Republicans have continued to work on that throughout the years. And I can tell you, Texas Democrats have not. You know, you have Beto O'Rourke complaining. Now, you saw the postmortem probably. Beto O'Rourke was complaining about the idea that they were hobbled and they, you know, couldn't go out and block walk and do field operations in this state when we know better than that. We know that that was a choice. And look, people have to live with their choices. Democrats decided to not go out into these communities and do what they needed to do to win. You will have some people say, well, the Republicans were being brazen by doing that during a pandemic, but there are consequences for our actions. And I think that Democrats were, frankly, they were underestimating people. And that was in Hispanic communities, that was in white communities, African-American communities, et cetera.
We've been talking a lot about the COVID strategy of Donald Trump. And the problem for Democrats is that the Republicans had Donald Trump as their backdrop. And Donald Trump basically was the super spreader. He didn't wear masks. He made mask wearing a political issue. And he kind of denied the pandemic. But that liberated Republicans who are more responsible to be able to do the lit drops, to knock on the doors, to step back, to wear the mask, to respect the pandemic. At the same time, they had the cover of a president who is in pandemic denial. The Democrats were between a rock and a hard place. you had Biden basically in his basement, basically completely talking about this pandemic right. in such a way that you shouldn't do anything that was in a sort of public setting or any kind of a social setting, even if it was a safe social setting. So the Democrats' messaging from the top was they weren't being given the cover to knock on doors and step back and wear a mask because they were being told you're supposed to sort of keep people safe by not associating with them. That was the message from the top. Very different messaging, which then ended up translating into what you saw happening in Texas, mm-hmm. which was there was the door knock by Republicans and the Democrats did not do that.
To bolster what you're saying, I did have a Republican strategist about a month ago. We were just in a private conversation. He said that the only thing that's going to save the Democrats around here, he's off record, deep background. Right now, he wouldn't care about me saying it. Because who wants to tip their hat on something like this? He says the only thing that will save the Democratic candidates around here is some statement from Biden from the top. Say it's okay to have interpersonal interactions as long as you're acting responsibly and safely.
Exactly.
Keep a distance. Because people are, Arnie, all during this, people are going to the grocery store.
Exactly.
You know, people are, I mean, and not everybody. I mean, we had polling that showed this is more sophisticated than people think. It's not, and it's more nuanced than people think. It's not just that there was a choice between knocking on doors and not knocking on doors. It's that there was polling that showed that the people who are just locked in their house and are having their groceries delivered and don't want to see anybody at all who they don't know, those were base Democrats. Polling showed that. Then on the other end, you had the complete deniers who didn't want there to be any restrictions, no masks, no distancing, no government regulations, no business shutdowns, nothing, nothing. Those are base Republicans. Yeah. But then there are people in the middle. This is the same, right? Then there are people in the middle who would say, as long as you got a mask, as long as you're kind of staying away from me and all that sort of stuff, then I don't mind it. And when I went along on one of these block walks back in September, most of the people who had their doors knocked on by campaign workers, they weren't offended by it. They were welcoming it because they hadn't seen anybody at their house in months. They were happy to have somebody talk to them. This was a moment when people who otherwise might have been bored by or kind of annoyed by somebody coming around to talk about politics were welcoming any kind of interaction. They were glad anybody was talking to them because they were thinking about it too simplistically. Here's the other thing I should say to add to that. It's not just that there's base Democrats who don't want you to knock on the door and there are base Republicans who don't want there to be any restrictions. It's that you can identify the houses where the people who would be open to it, where they live. You've done this. They have software where they hand it out to the volunteers or the workers on the campaign. So these are the addresses you're going to go visit today. They're not picking those at random, right? They have past voting history on those people. And they say, at this house, this is where a Democrat lives. At this house, this is where Republicans live. At this house, there are two Republicans and one Democrat, which means there's a mom and a dad and a teenage daughter. They have a level of sophistication when they do this. It's not like they were just knocking on anybody's door. They were going into the interactions knowing who would be open to having the conversation. And Democrats decided to not do that.
I have a real quick question before I let
you. Unbelievable to me, honestly.
A couple minutes left because now Governor Abbott still has his Republican legislature, but we are seeing COVID spiking. We do know that the pandemic is beginning to really have this incredible winter rage. We also know that Texas is one state that has the highest number of uninsured people in the United States.
That's correct.
And as the pandemic spikes, there is going to be greater unemployment. It's going to have economic consequences for the employment situation, not just in Texas, but across the country. Will Texas consider embracing the expansion of Medicaid?
There is a new movement on that. Some business leaders held a press conference that I attended in Dallas a few weeks ago, including the North Dallas Chamber of Commerce and the Hospital Association up there and others, business people who are saying what we need is expansion of coverage of healthcare. They're trying to move away from the term Medicaid expansion because it makes the eyes of Republican primary voters twitch when they say Medicaid expansion. And so they don't want to talk about that. But they are saying that if you run the numbers in Texas and we are coming up against a terrible budget shortfall because of COVID, a lot of every state is dealing with this. We expect at least a $4.6 billion shortfall when the legislature meets in January. And so writing that state budget, which is a $250 billion document written over a 24-month horizon, it's a heavy lift, especially, it's hard enough when you don't come in with a $5 billion shortfall, which, by the way, Arnie, that's the official estimate from the state comptroller. It could be worse than that, right? Because we haven't seen the economy come back in a way that it needs to be for the state budget to work. And also, we're very reliant still on oil and gas severance taxes in Texas. And I should look here. What we need oil to be at, I'm going to pull up this number for you so I tell you the right thing. In the state budget as currently written to maintain the current commitments that we've made as a state, we really need oil to be around something like $55 a barrel, at least. $70 a barrel would be ideal.
Aren't we under 40?
Oh, yeah. We're at 30. That's what I was looking to tell you the right number. We're at 38.98 this morning.
I follow it, too, because of you.
Yeah, right.
Because of you.
Well, interestingly, when these price wars open up with Saudi Arabia, the kinds of promises that they have made to their people in their country, they tax oil and gas just like we do. For them to honor commitments they've made, they also need it to be around $70, something like that.
On that note, we love Scott Braddock. He is the dean of the Austin Press Corps, the editor of the Quorum Report. And if you want to learn anything about Texas, you have to tune in to The Attitude on Friday with Scott Braddock. All right, we'll schmooze next week. Thank you so much, Scott.
Thanks, Arnie. Talk soon.
All right, ciao. Stick around. We'll be right back. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Stephanie Collins and Dave Scott.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1945. That was the day workers in Windsor, Ontario, walked off the job in a general strike to support strikers at Ford Motor Company. 20,000 CIO workers brought the city's industrial production to a complete standstill. 11,000 members of UAW Local 200 had been on strike against Ford since September 12th. They demanded a union shop and dues checkoff. As the strike wore on, picket lines swelled every day with as many as 1,000 to 2,000 amassing at the gates to stop scabs. Then, on this day, more than 9,000 additional members of Amalgamated UAW Local 195, working at 27 area plants, joined them in support. Thousands of picketers set up a blockade at Ford's Riverfront plant that tied up the city's transit system. Sandwich Street was choked with cars, buses, and trucks. More than 1,000 cars were bumper to bumper in an endless traffic jam as strikers worked to prevent a police attack on the picket lines. The two-mile blockade and general strike were in effect for 2 days until the government threatened to send in federal troops to aid provincial and Canadian police. Thousands continued to picket. By November 12th, AFL and CIO leaders throughout Canada were calling for a work holiday to show support. Then, on December 19th, workers agreed to binding arbitration. Supreme Court Justice Ivan Rand was assigned the case. He ruled against the closed shop, but for dues checkoff. He put forth a series of rules and penalties regarding labor disputes that would come to be known as the Rand Formula. It has served as the basis for labor relations and collective bargaining in Canada ever since.
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Corner store like it was a nightclub.
Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is part two of the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. If it's Friday, it must be Bill Curry. Bill Curry ran for governor in the state of Connecticut twice. He was an advisor to Bill Clinton. He has written for Salon.com. He was part of the nuclear freeze movement. As so many of my listeners say, one of the most thoughtful people I have on my radio show. So I am very grateful that he gives us his time and attention once a week. Last time we talked, there was no decision. It is now Friday, actually, we're resuming Thursday morning. There is still no decision on this election, except it does feel like Joe Biden might, in fact, get enough Electoral College votes to win this election. He clearly had the popular vote. The Democrats lost in many ways. They lost the House of Representatives. They didn't lose the House, but they didn't gain the numbers they thought. They lost seats. The Democrats were not able to flip the Senate. In fact, they lost. They may have even lost. Well, I'm not sure they lost seats, but I think they didn't get to what they were accomplishing. A lot of Democrats were sort of surprised by what happened in legislatures around the country as well, because this is such a pivotal election, because it is an election with the census, and that means redistricting happening within the next election cycle. So stepping back, I guess I need to ask you, Bill Curry, even though we don't have final numbers yet, what was the message of 2020? What did we learn from this election, other than you fear the Electoral College and you know that, you know, there's a popular vote that says one thing, an electoral vote that doesn't always reflect the popular vote, but there has to be more than just voting. It has to be about what is the message.
The question runs both ways. What message were we sending the voters and what message were they sending us?
Exactly.
And I think, again, one of the problems for me with the Biden campaign throughout this has been how much it's reminded me of the Hillary campaign. Biden himself as a personality doesn't remind you of Hillary. His politics are not much, very dissimilar to hers, but he is a different person, and that's important. He was also a better politician. When he got the nomination, when he consolidated the nomination prior to the convention, he did lots of outreach to the rest of his party, which is what any politician does. That's what all politicians did up until Hillary, to the best of my knowledge, who made zero effort. She complained bitterly that Bernie wasn't helping her, but made zero effort to bring Bernie and his people into the campaign. Of course, they weren't helping her as much. They felt profoundly disrespected. Biden did not repeat that mistake. And he also took much of their policy in. This was a platform I'd be proud to run on. And so right through the convention, he was doing things right, and it made me feel better. And then he did two things that Hillary did. One, he forgot all the progressive messaging he'd accepted for the platform. He stopped running on it, and he stopped running on it in a way that was clear and decisive, and he stopped elevating the themes of economic justice and political reform and middle-class prosperity. He stopped elevating those to the center. If there was one way in which COVID actually helped Trump, it is that once again, the Democrats engaged in magical thinking, that there was this one issue this time that was going to just bail them out. And that just never
true. And that issue was not Trump? Or that issue was the pandemic?
That issue was the pandemic. It was both, actually. It's Trump's handling of the pandemic. And then also, just as Hillary had done, it was slightly different in its details. The belief that any day now, everyone's going to catch on to what a big jerk he is. The condescension toward Trump on our part, and the assumption that everybody was going to come around to our way of thinking about him, which is understandable. He's such a horror show. He's such a failure of a human being. It is so obvious. Our feelings about him transcend the political by so much. I understand the temptation. I fall to it myself. But two things. One, when you just condescend to Trump or just criticize him, his supporters feel criticized. His ability to express their grievances and present himself as the avatar of their sense of disenfranchisement and even persecution has been the secret sauce of his political success. Again, I'm shocked that people could get as high as being major advisors in presidential campaigns and not see something that obvious and not take steps to correct it. And the other thing, so one price you pay is that, you know, whoever gets down in the mud with Trump gets dirty. Trump was already dirty. And you become like him, and you also begin to get the distinctions down to make it harder for people to make the distinctions, rather. But the other thing is that you take up all the room you should have used to explain your own policies and ideas. The way to move this guy out was to show people a better life without it. Anybody who thinks life is terrible under him, we got that vote already. If you haven't woken up to that, I heard this from so many Democrats. Well, we've had 4 years of Trump now. They've been seeing it. It's different. I thought, wow, everything we know about Trump, we knew in 2016. The Hollywood Access tape came out. The horrible moment, my worst Trump moment will always be his bullying, sarcastic imitation of the disabled reporter. The speech he gave after coming down the escalator. Everything
John
about
McCain.
Him was on the
John
public
McCain
record.
Was in prison, you know?
I mean, yeah, and so if we didn't get it then, there's a lots of reasons we didn't get it now. And that just goes, I'll stop here once, but that just goes to another thing. And so our inability both to refute charges made against us and also to lay out that broader economic vision in clear terms. If Joe Biden had talked about nothing but a living wage and the public option, this election would have been certified in his favor already.
You're in a lot of ways, some of that is reinforced. And so we had a really fascinating conversation yesterday, but let me sort of reflect, I mean, the day before, but let me just reflect on what happened. Is that I look at Florida. Okay, so Trump won Florida. They were able to convince everyone that Joe Biden was a socialist, especially to the Cuban population, which was so powerful in Florida. But the shocking, shocking result that happened at the same time as you see Donald Trump is that on the ballot was an increase of the minimum wage to $15, not 12, not 9, but to 15. It gets up there slowly, but it needed to pass by over 60% of the vote. It was a freaking heavy bar. It passed by 60.8%. I believe that was the last. Remember, we're Zooming this, everyone, on Thursday morning. That was the last count. But it passed. As you look at what you were talking about, economic policy, the value of the worker, that you should be paid for the worth of your work, look at Donald Trump, who has trashed everything that sort of even sort of has respect for those people. They're expendable. They can die in his super spreader events. And yet they voted for him and they voted for increasing the minimum wage to $15. Look at that message. I want someone to sort of sit me on a couch and explain it. Is it a failure of the Democrats to have that economic message? Or is it a disconnect between the fact that that economic message is something that rebounds to Democrats and not to Trump, or that they own it because they voted for it?
I think that, first of all, if the voters are failing to make a connection, that's what political leaders have to do. They have to help them make the connection.
Thank you.
Joe Biden's job in Florida was to say simply, one, I'm for increasing the living wage, and Trump isn't. I'm with you. He's not.
I know.
I'm going to do a public option that brings a million of you health care and millions of you cheaper health care. All he wants to do is take away the health care you have and a pandemic. He wasn't making those kinds of distinctions. Just, you know, the constant stuff about the COVID. There are other things people wanted to know. As the exit polls, the highly unreliable exit polls, but nonetheless vaguely instructive, say that people cared more about the economy than they cared about COVID. I'm not sure that's true. But they cared a lot about the economy and its effect on them. We always do. It's always the economy to some large degree. And it all cuts in our favor. How a party that enjoys majority public support on all the issues the public cares about most fails to win an election against someone who's deeply mentally ill and fascistic is something for us to really swallow. Just as the Republicans after 2012 were saying, we have to talk about outreach. We have to figure out how we do better with diversity. The Democrats after 2016 needed to figure out what was wrong with our message and what was wrong with our policy.
Yes.
And just as the Republicans didn't want to have their discussion, we didn't want to have ours.
Right.
We still need to have it. I still believe that there's a hidden consensus within this apparently deeply divided country, and that it is in its essence progressive. I don't doubt that for a moment. And that, however, there are basic issues. As I'm always telling my progressive friends and interviews and audiences, and we don't have to compromise with the fossil fuel industry. We don't have to compromise with the health insurance industry. We can make vast progress in taming the military-industrial complex. We don't have to compromise there. We do have to compromise with the voters. The voters have some concerns which are conservative. I am almost never able to get my progressive friends to admit this. But each side, you know, I used to say about all my white people I worked in the White House that, who wrote memoirs, that every memoir could have been titled, If Only They'd Listened to Me. We're all that way. Just these last few days, there are two things. I talked about the similarity of Biden's campaign to Hillary's. One right. of which is that both were populated at the top and throughout by people who deplore the voters who are supporting Trump. I've heard more of my personal beloved friends have called me to say that the problem is the racism of the American people or how reactionary the American people is. And I always say two things. One, well, that's great because that means I can switch from politics to gardening. Because if you're right, there's nothing we can do about it.
I've always said this, you've heard me say it before, but I sort of retranslated this because I was trying to figure out what happened in Florida with the $15 minimum wage. I wrote, Trump's voters are philosophically selfish and conservative, but operationally socialist and liberal. Let me just say this.
Few of them would call themselves that. Go ahead.
No. But we're all selfish. That's not a bad thing. We are all selfish. And to acknowledge that is not to say that you only want that as part of the values and what you're marketing. You understand you're selfish. You want your family to be okay. You want your paycheck to be bigger. You want your healthcare to be cheap. You want your doctor there when you're sick. That's kind of selfish. What I think the Democrats need to say is, in order for you to embrace that selfish, guess what? We have to raise the minimum wage for everyone. Because in the end, it gets you. We have to make healthcare better for everyone because in the end, it gets cheaper for you. We understand what you want. We want to get what you want. But you know what? I can't be voter specific because in a way that would be corrupt if I just got it for you. But if I got it for your community, guess what? You get what you need. And I don't know how we can frame that. That doesn't make government or policy bad. It means it understands your selfishness and reminds you that's how I deliver for you.
And yet again, I often say, if you think back to Hillary's race, it's hard to answer the question, what was she running on?
Yeah.
Everybody can list off the top of their heads Trump's top five issues, and nobody can list off the top of their head hers. And I invite all of your listeners to try. It's like one of those Chinese thumb deal things that you learn. It's very, very difficult. We can't just say, if only they listen to us as progressives. There are things about what they hear from us that we don't explain well enough. They have some legitimate questions we haven't answered. I've talked about this before, but the first one is, how much does that cost? We spent the year in a fiscal bidding war in the Democratic presidential primaries and in a cultural awareness bidding war among the candidates without explaining ourselves. Every time we did it, we were profiling for our base rather than explaining to the rest of the country. Mm-hmm. There was no position we took that we couldn't take, but you couldn't take it in a way that condescended, and you couldn't take it without explanation. The reputation of the Democratic Party, as reflected in polls, went down over the course of the Democratic presidential primaries. The overall identification with us as an alternative to Trump. If anybody realized at the top that this was because of how we'd been talking out loud in public for 6 months, they didn't notice. You have to answer those questions like, how much does it cost? The second question is always, does this really work? And the third question is, will you keep me safe?
Exactly.
And it doesn't mean you get into a cops and a law and order bidding war. You can show, as I ran for governor in 1994, and stealing, I think, from Neil Kinnock, the phrase, tough on crime, tough on its causes, showing how if we do fix the underlying problems, we'll all get safer. And people knew it. People responded to it overwhelmingly. I'm very proud I introduced the first public option in the United States in 1991 to open up the state employee health care plan to everyone in Connecticut. We almost passed it, despite all, imagine the insurance state. and then a couple years later, I ran for governor. And I polled it for the first time. I mean, and everybody liked it. Everybody was for it. There are things like that. I mean, we just didn't take our signature issues and drive them home. And by the way, the Democratic Party intermittently claims to be for fighting corruption. Pelosi and Schumer both said it was the number one priority of Democrats after they won in 2018. And they did pass a bill soon thereafter, knowing it was going nowhere. And to the best of my knowledge, never mentioned it again. I want to go to the corruption issue a little bit. Another problem for Biden is that, like Hillary, he was not well positioned to bring the argument. Also, for that reason, stayed away from it. John Kerry did it in 2004 because he decided not to take public financing of presidential campaigns again and thought, therefore, anything he said would look hypocritical. So he shut down. He actually took the Democratic Party's historic commitment to campaign finance reform out of the 2004 party platform. That's how far they were. They just took it out. Again, that corruption issue itself, Trump has a teapot dome in every agency. This is the most corrupt administration by far in the history of this country. We spent the fall talking about Hunter Biden, while Eric Trump is testifying before a grand jury for crimes he seems almost certain to have committed.
Right.
And that very week, the only thing we're talking about is Hunter Biden. Biden himself just sort of, you know, slipped away from those issues when we had to drive them home. When we chose him, we didn't take the issue seriously enough to wonder if having such a vulnerability might be a disqualification.
Right.
And above all, by the way, because Hunter Biden didn't break any laws, the Trumps have broken thousands of laws. I'm pretty sure Hunter Biden's never broken a law. There's never been a law cited in all the scandal mongering. No one on Fox News or in the Trump White House has ever cited a specific statute they thought was violated, just as in their current charges of corruption in the campaign. They've never cited a specific instance of a specific illegality or unethical practice. They just shout corruption.
Oh, okay. So
we should have been able to answer it.
I have two questions. So he's not going to have a Senate to work with Joe Biden. We already know that Mitch McConnell has already started to talk about what he's going to do to stymie anything that Joe Biden wants. But Joe Biden does have power. And his power is in the executive branch, as we saw with Donald Trump, who used the executive branch as a whipping boy for himself. But we now know that you can invite back all those bureaucrats that fled. That's the first thing you can do. So you can really sort of improve and give muscle back to your agencies. You can also fight corruption, because you might have an attorney general, depending on who you appoint, who might actually be able to go after corruption. It doesn't involve the Senate. It involves the attorney general and justice. So he can deal with corruption. He can begin to improve what's happening within the bureaucracy and restore the bureaucracy and have them sort of re-triage what they will enforce and what they won't enforce by using their prosecutorial discretion. He can also do executive orders.
Let me just say, this is so critical what you're saying.
Good.
There are two things. First of all, the House can do real oversight now because if Biden wins, because the documents and witnesses won't be withheld.
Will be forthcoming.
And it is critical that we establish a record of everything that happened in the last 4 years, critical to the preservation of our democracy. But the second thing is the Obama anti-corruption platform in 2008, the Obama-Biden platform on corruption, was terrific. And as with Donald Trump's Drain the Swamp, the peroration of Obama's stump speech down the stretch in 2008 was fixing Washington, fixing its culture. And that all the promises he made were very important. And with the exception of campaign finance reform, everything else, revolving door, competitive bidding, not letting lobbyists run agencies that govern prior clients, all those could be done by executive order.
Exactly.
Obama kept none of the promises. And those were, if you look at that platform, look at that campaign, the most explicit promises he made and the ones he talked about the most were about public corruption. That's what his pollsters, like Trump's pollsters later, would tell him was the single thing that would drive the election. Trump took his anti-immigration ads off the air to replace them with Drain the Swamp ads that were entirely then about big corporations having too much influence. It later, Drain the Swamp later meant kill all the Democrats.
Biden can do
the most effective anti-corruption agenda in the history of the presidency just through executive orders. Aren't even jurisdictional questions.
All right, so let me just say something. So we have Donald Trump running on Drain the Swamp, right? Remember, we heard that over and over again. What if Joe Biden says, you know, I want to extend an olive branch to the Trump supporters. I'm here to tell you that what Donald Trump talked about draining the swamp, I'm here to fulfill it. I am going to drain the swamp. I understand your message and I understand you want it. And I'm here to produce.
And none of his donors and none of his pollsters understood it. And the Democratic Party has to divorce its big donors and fire its pollsters in order to make one step forward on any of this. Let me just name two other things, by the way. Climate change, we can't get new legislation, but simply restoring everything that all the executive orders that Trump destroyed and dealing with the foreign affairs part of climate change, of working with other governments, going back to the Paris Accord, and then working with other nations, and then finding ways. If we have the House and the White House, it's enough to get our most important items into any budget. And that's what we should trade for. When we're doing the budget trade for climate change progress. That's the most important thing. And so climate change and corruption, and there's so many things about climate change that can be done by executive order. It's a long, long list of things he can do. And by the way, some of the things, there are plenty of Republican senators who are vulnerable. If it's a 52-48 Senate and we have the House and the White House, we can actually pass legislation on climate change. There are a number of them who will not want to be identified on the opposite side of that issue. in 2 years. So corruption, climate change, and foreign policy, all questions of national security, are unilateral militarism that we've been addicted to throughout my life and for a long time before it. The secrecy, if we did nothing but declassify millions of documents and let people see what we've really done, what we're really like, and make a commitment that we won't make decisions in the dark. When we do things openly and publicly in foreign affairs, we generally do things that make me proud as an American. The Alliance for Progress or the Marshall Plan. I'm fine with all of it and even proud of a good deal of it. Whenever we do something in secret, condone assassinations in Chile and Vietnam, secret covert invasions, torture, bribery, all of that, that's when I'm ashamed. And one thing to do is to open it up and to promise that we're not going to make foreign policy in the dark anymore. And so applying a strong version of freedom of information laws to national security questions. And then number two, on foreign affairs, we require corporations through something called the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. We require them, and used to enforce this law, we stopped in the last 4 years. We had some enforcement prior. We require them not to go around bribing customers in foreign countries. We should take Republicans always say that the government should live by the same rules that applies to business. Well, here's a good example. We should apply the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act to ourselves by engaging in so much bribery, billions of bribes in Iraq alone. We have exported not democracy, but corruption. We have exported far more corruption than democracy in the name of exporting democracy. Let's have a Foreign Corrupt Practices Act for the government. Let's have freedom of information. And let's begin to renounce the kinds of foreign policy. And by the way, Trump has inadvertently laid the groundwork for that. There's three big areas where you can make lots of progress, even with Mitch McConnell still in the saddle.
And your point about the sort of our foreign policy and our military budget is that people are now beginning to understand what makes them insecure. What makes them insecure is climate change. What makes them insecure is a pandemic. What makes them insecure is seeing their rural hospitals being shut down. What makes them insecure is that they see their bridges failing. And so when we're talking about security now, I think we get to redefine it for the American people, and it doesn't go through the Pentagon. And I think if you can begin to sort of, and use the word security, use the word keep you safe over, it's your mantra.
What keeps you safe?
What keeps you safe?
And you know, we're going to keep whatever part of the military really keeps us safe. I'll vote for that. And a good deal of it is important.
Right.
However, a lot of it is spent on these vast weapon systems and huge standing armies that were proven recently in the Middle East, read Afghanistan and Iraq and Libya, not to be effective against the real threats we have today. Get up and say it. Get up and say it. You're wasting this money. Every penny of it that I think keeps you safer, I'm willing to spend.
It's going to be fascinating to see what happens as a result of this election. And of course, we're talking on Friday, although this is being Zoomed on Thursday. We do not know whether it is going to be President Trump or President Biden, but if nothing else, it's going to be about change no matter what happens. Bill Kirk, thank you so much for joining us. I need to let you go. This is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We'll schmooze on Monday. Ciao. You better-